And with me this morning is Eleanor Lister from Berry & Lamberts, who kindly sponsor our breakfast show. But she told me she hasn't had any breakfast. Now, the weekend was very, very hot, and so this morning I'm sitting here in the studio in my baggy shorts, string vest, and a knotted handkerchief on my head, and Eleanor's sitting opposite me looking very, very elegant. I don't know how she can do it in this hot weather. So welcome.
Hello.
Right, we're going to be speaking about property matters over the next few months, yes. And today we're doing conveyancing. What is conveyancing?
So, in a nutshell, conveyancing is the act of buying or selling a property. Most of us at some point in our lives will experience moving house. Those of us that are very fortunate will experience buying or selling a house. And when doing so, you need a conveyancer involved. Nowadays, there are lots of different ways that you can find yourself a conveyancer, and there's various different ways that you can qualify to be a conveyancer. But what we all do is fundamentally the same thing. It is the process of buying or selling that house.
Okay, let's go how to choose a conveyancer.
Oh, a very good question, and there are lots of things to consider. Certainly, the marketing that we receive from all companies that are offering conveyancing services will be very similar, which is, we can do this process for you. However, when you're actually looking to find someone to do the conveyancing for you, that can be quite a stressful process, because this is not something that we're doing regularly. I always recommend trying to talk to the individual that will actually be doing the service for you. What you will often find is you will build up a rapport with that person, because you're going to have to come across difficulties or stressful things, and having someone that you can pick up the phone to and speak to is very, very good. Without that, it will be a more stressful experience. If that person is not willing to speak to you at the very outset, then you're not going to be able to get to them after they've won your business, effectively. Often, estate agents will be able to send you in the direction of reputable local conveyancers, but I would always recommend that you ask those people the question, which is, are you being paid for this recommendation? If the answer to that is yes, that's not a true recommendation. It's just a referral. And when you have those kind of things in mind, what you'll find is you can really weed out the good people that are going to give you a good quality of service.
Okay, so I've decided to sell my property, mm-hmm. and I've appointed a conveyancer.
Yeah.
And what are the first things that he or she want to know?
Very good. So the first things that you're going to be asked about are, of course, the details of the property. But I'm going to imagine that we've done the quote, you've chosen your conveyancer. So what's then going to happen is they're going to ask you for some ID. It's something that in recent years, this hasn't been so much of an issue for people. But certainly when I first started doing this job, when you ask people for ID, there was a sense of offence almost. But the reality is we have to check that it's not a fraudster selling your house.
Yes. There have been cases of that.
There have, many. So we have to be very, very careful. Once we've done your ID, then we'll give you some forms to fill in, which will be given to your buyers. And those forms explain lots of things about the property. There's two forms specifically when you're selling a freehold, or three for a leasehold flat. And they go through various different, very practical details about the property. What furniture are you taking or leaving? Is the fridge staying? Is the microwave staying? And you then go into the more complicated details of, but still very practical, when was the boiler installed? Have you done any building works, etc.? We then use those details along with the details that we get from the land registry, etc., to create a pack which is sent to your buyer's solicitor, who will then start the investigative process.
And roughly how long does that initial process take? It depends on the client, is what I know.
So this is something that we often find, is that people can get very intimidated at the beginning of this process. Of course, most of us in our day-to-day lives don't deal with solicitors. So when we're in a position where suddenly we've got a solicitor, we've got a bunch of forms, at that point we'll get a bit intimidated. But actually, when you look at the forms, they're nice and straightforward. They follow your nose. Lots of people will get me those forms back before the end of the day. Other people will go through them very slowly and very carefully. But once we have those forms back from our clients, it will take us a day or two to process, and we will then send the contract paperwork across to the buyers.
So we could say roughly, depending on the client, if they're getting back to you within a week,
yes,
stuff will be sent across to the buyer.
Exactly. Yeah. So generally speaking, from the moment that we're instructed, we receive the estate agent's memorandum, which tells us who the other solicitor is. We get the names of both the buyer and the seller, the property address, the sale price, etc. Once we've got that, normally in your average transaction, you're looking at roughly a week for those initial contracts to be sent out.
And how long does it take to get things from the land registry these days?
Actually, that's fairly instant. The difficulty there is making sure that you get the right property. Every now and again, for example, you might have one high street and one A and one B and one C. You don't want to accidentally put down the wrong one. I have one at the moment where the client knows of their property as, to give a random number, 100. High Street, but actually on the land registry title it's known as 100A High Street. So in those cases you've just got to be a bit careful, because we don't want to be spending your money in getting the wrong stuff.
So it's down to the client to make sure they've got things right to begin with, but if not, it's extra cost.
Or just an extra investigation. I mean, yeah. I'm very lucky with my team in that they're all... They should be PIs rather than secretaries. They're very, very good at picking these things up. And again, that's the advantage of using a very well-established team.
Right, we're going to come back to common pitfalls and how to avoid them or remedy them after we've had this. 95.5, 106.7 FM, online on your smart speaker, semaphore, Morse code. We are universally communicating. Ignore the Morse code and the semaphore. My arms aren't up to it this morning. You're listening to West Kent Today. With me is Eleanor Lister from Berry & Lamberts. Mm-hmm. And we are talking about conveyancing, so buying and selling houses. And we've done a basic outline of the process of what the conveyancer will do for you. And we're going to look at some of the common pitfalls and how we can try to avoid them or remedy them. So let's. What's a common pitfall?
I mean, this is my day job, so I come across all kinds of things, some much more common than others, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I think probably one of the biggest pitfalls during the conveyancing process is things not moving at the same speed as one another in various different parts of the process. So, for example, you might have a very keen seller with a very relaxed buyer, and that will cause some stress and tension for both parties, because of course the seller is desperate to get the transaction done, and it can cause real anxiety thinking that the other person is not so keen. Equally, you can have the more relaxed buyer who perhaps in the background is trying to sort out their finances, and so those two people can cause real stress to themselves and the transaction as a whole, because of course it's very, very stressful buying and selling a house. This is the kind of thing that I would say more than anything is that the biggest pitfall is the stress involved in the transaction.
And as if you've got more in the chain.
Of course, the more in the chain, the more opportunity there is for that kind of disparity to appear. But equally, you might find that there's a solicitor that's overburdened and therefore struggling to keep up with their workload, and at that point you will really find that everybody's sitting and waiting on the professional, and that feels very frustrating. As one of the professionals, I know very much that this poor person is probably working all the hours that God sends, but that doesn't make it feel any better for the people participating. And And the best way to try and avoid these stresses, as simple as it sounds, is for everybody to communicate as clearly as they can. Make sure that your solicitor is nudging and chasing at appropriate times. Talk to them and see where they're at. Because the reality is most of us are working very, very hard for a lot of people and trying our best to keep our finger on all the different pulses. But that doesn't mean that you're not important. And therefore, you know, we do want to try and get things progressed for you.
In one way, it's like juggling jelly, isn't it?
Oh, yes, or herding cats, pushing fog up a hill, depending on what day of the week it is. But yes, it's there's a lot going on. And for everybody, there's a lot going on. And we just push through. And communicating with your client is the key to trying to make the processes as unstressful as possible. It's going to be stressful.
Okay, say I was buying and selling.
Mm-hmm.
You would also be informing my buyer's solicitor,
mm-hmm.
and also the seller's solicitor. So you've got three solicitors in that particular change you're doing.
Exactly. So for two houses, you will have three solicitors. You'll also have, we'd have probably two estate agents involved, three solicitors, and three individuals. On top of that, you've got the potential for two mortgage brokers and various other different parties you've also got to think about. And, of course, for the individuals that are buying and selling, they've also got to sort removals, their house insurance, their mortgage, their survey. The list goes on and on and on. But from my perspective, you've got three solicitors, three people, two estate agents, two mortgage brokers potentially to be juggling with. So lots of people to talk to.
And there are occasions when communication breaks down?
Absolutely, yes. And it can be very, very hard at that point to manage a transaction. You only need a lawyer to go AWOL or a client to suddenly disappear. I remember it's a long time ago now, but I had someone find out they were unexpectedly pregnant and disappeared off the face of the earth for about 7 weeks whilst they processed it.
Gosh.
Which is all well and good, other than the fact that I'm being shouted at by various people and I'm like, I just don't know where she is, I'm sorry.
So officially you deal with two other solicitors in that particular chain, but supposing it's a chain of four people,
mm-hmm.
who knows about that fourth one?
So this is the agents, and this is the importance of the estate agents in the transaction. So as the solicitor, I'm really only meant to speak to my own client and the solicitor on either side of me and the two estate agents dealing with those two properties. I often won't know anything about the rest of the chain. The estate agents will do, as part of their own investigations at the very outset, effectively what's known as a chain check. And they will then have somewhere a list of the different properties involved, possibly the people, and also the estate agents along the chain so that they can keep that side of things running as smoothly as possible. And each agent basically keeps an eye on the solicitor dealing with their sale, if they possibly can.
So have the estate agent got a responsibility to keep the client informed of where the chain is all the way along?
They will try their best.
Okay, it's not a confidentiality thing. They can't talk about buyer one, buyer two.
So they won't be naming them.
Right.
They certainly won't be giving you their names. But often the updates that I will receive will be, I've spoken to the estate agent at the top of the chain and their seller is still waiting to find a house to buy. So there's a pause on the chain for that reason, for example. So it will be an update that's useful and productive, but I won't know the names or even the addresses of the properties involved. So it's just then my client understands what's happening and where there's a hold up or where there isn't a hold up, but without having those kind of confidential details that could get people in trouble.
But you can inform your client and say, we've got to this far, we can't proceed any further until this happens.
Exactly. And that will help ease those kind of transactional worries that clients get.
Because it can be quite stressful. You know, I'm going bald and grey. I'm only 21.
and looking beautiful for
it. Oh, gosh, you can come again. Right, let's have Python Lee Jackson out in A Broken Dream, and we'll come back after we've had the travel. I'm sure there must be law against it. No, you can't tame the Zara, don't even try. You're listening to West Kent Today. With me is Eleanor Lister from Berry & Lamberts. We're talking about property matters, and we are on about pitfalls. So back over to you, Eleanor.
So I'm trying to think of which ones are very common, and normally what starts to happen is beyond those kind of timescale issues and the differing priorities, the next thing that's most common is the buyer solicitor finding something wrong in the paperwork, which sounds horrendous when you first say it, but it's always worth highlighting that it's a matter of personal pride almost for us to find something, and it demonstrates to our own clients that we're doing our jobs. And the reality of the situation is almost never will we find a client who can give us the perfect set of complete paperwork. So normally what will come up are things like, you've not provided me with a boiler installation certificate. Now, there are then two options. I will go to my client as the seller's solicitor and I will say to them, do you have the boiler installation certificate? Now, the reality is most of us either don't keep those papers in a very neat place at home, at which case people go around and do some digging at home and find it. Often people will then have to go back to their installer and say to them, do you have a copy of this? Because I'm not sure I've received it. We see that a lot, particularly now that they're electric. And those PDFs are a lot easier to lose, I think.
Yes, and many people, many installers, as I discovered, don't issue a certificate. They just give you the QR code to register directly with the boiler makers.
And nobody thinks anything of that until they come to sell the house. And then suddenly they're like, I need that. But then if they contact those installers, generally speaking, they can get it. If it has been properly registered, I can also get that information, or you can get those information, that kind of thing, online. Nowadays, you can often buy a replacement certificate online. It's very quick and easy, so it's certainly not the end of the world. What becomes slightly more of a challenge is where something has been installed at the property that required building regulations, but either the installer was a mate from down the pub, or the installer simply forgot to do the paperwork at the time. At that point, technically speaking, you're in breach of building regulations, and the local authority could, strictly speaking, take enforcement action. The reality is, as I think we all know, councils have much bigger priorities than whether or not your boiler's got the right certificate to go with it. So what we as conveyancers need to do is take a fairly pragmatic approach to these things. If that certificate is not available, then what we would be doing is looking to obtain what's called indemnity insurance, which would protect the buyer in the future against any losses they incurred as a result of enforcement action. And indemnity insurance isn't just for lack of building regulations. It's a very common thing, and we use that all the time. I like to describe it as a sticking plaster. It covers up that problem. Yeah. It's not fixing the problem by any stretch, but it covers up that problem, and it gives buyers the confidence to be able to progress in the transaction more easily.
Yeah, and things have got slightly more complicated with everything going electronic. As I say, I've just had a new boiler installed almost 3 years ago, and a warm air replacement unit.
Yeah,
got all the paperwork, registered, everything. I control the thermostat through my phone, but now I'm selling the property, all that information has got to be transferred somehow. The person who takes over has got to register it herself, but it's still under warranty, all the services have been done.
Yeah,
I'm in the clear. I don't think I need indemnity insurance.
No, in that kind of situation, it sounds like you've got it all under control. But it's something that actually, as a technophobe myself, these kind of the hive heating, those kind of details, when I'm asked questions, I'm there on Google, like, what does this mean? Although, to be honest, Most of the time what happens is our sellers will put together a little welcome pack, as it were, for their buyers, and with the instructions as to how these kind of things can be done. The official paperwork comes through the lawyers, but in the same way that you're leaving your burglar alarm code and your front door key in a little welcome pack, you can put those kind of details in there as well.
I'm not going to say anything about burglar alarms because I haven't got one.
Well, surprisingly, it turns out lots of people don't.
No, we're in an area. In a lovely, safe area. Yes. Yeah. I have a heck of a job getting in anyway. But I have got all the keys ready to give to the estate agent and all the paperwork I've been putting in place.
Exactly.
Right, so any other things that we should be looking for then?
Obviously, we can't cover every pitfall, so I'll try and trot through a couple of ones that we see relatively frequently. The one that I seem to be coming across an awful lot at the moment is short leases. So when you're selling a flat, you are selling a lease. And a right to live in that flat, and we can discuss the difference between freeholds and leaseholds in a bit more detail later on. But what you will realise is that your lease is a right to live in a flat for a certain length of time. And of course, that time ticks downwards as you've lived in the flat for a longer time. And often when a flat has been around for 20 or more years, you start to see that the lease term gets quite short. Now, for most of us, the lease is going to live longer than we do. However, mortgage lenders in particular and buyers, the lease starts to lose value because you've got less time to live in that property, in that flat. And therefore, what we then try and do is extend those leases out so that there's a much longer period. It's normally 80 or 90 years, or sometimes even 999 years to take the problem away forevermore. But once you start extending these leases, you get the complications of the paperwork involved.
So if somebody lives in a place and they've been there and the lease is only got a couple more years to run and they weren't aware of it, can they be evicted?
Yes, in a word. So your lease is a right to live in the property for a certain number of years. And once that time runs out, the owner of the freehold, which is not always the same person as the flat owner, has the right to end the lease in accordance with the terms of the lease and say, right, your right to live here is now expired, off you go, which is why it's so essential to extend those leases.
Right. Well, we're going to come back to that because we've got leaseholds versus freeholds and what share of freehold means, because all these things get tied up.
Yes.
But we're going to have Katie Melua. I love like that. Katie Melua, I love like that. Are you listening to West Kent Today? With me is Eleanor Lister from Berry & Lamberts, and we're talking about conveyancing and property matters, and we're just moving on now to leaseholds versus freeholds and what share of freehold means. Over to you for the complicated bit.
So I'll try not to make it too complicated. In a nutshell, often the easiest way for people to think about it, and it, obviously it's a lot more nuanced than this, but an easy way to visualise it is often most houses are freehold and most flats are leasehold. What freehold means is that you own the house, the land, the sky above, the ground below, in theory. The reality is most of us aren't digging to the centre of the earth or waving big flags up in the sky. And I think since the advent of aeroplanes, etc., obviously the sky thing has been a little bit more contentious, but the reality is most of us aren't interested in our flight paths above our houses. And when you own a freehold, subject to whatever rights and obligations are set out on your title, that is your land to do with as you see fit. We then have leasehold. Now, leasehold is the more complicated of the two, because somebody will own the freehold of the building And they will then own the garden land around it, the sky, the bit up below, of course, and the structure of the building. But then what they do is they grant leases out of the various different parts of the building. So if we imagine a three-story building with three flats on it, the landlord will grant out in the individual flats, if we imagine we have the freehold as a cardboard box, inside that big box is a little box. That little box, in this analogy, is your leasehold flat. And so you own the right to live in that flat. You do not own the building. And your lease will set out what you actually own and what rights you have, what obligations you have, the length of time that you have these rights and obligations. And that will all go into your lease. And that is the terms under which you live and you own the leasehold interest. Unlike your freehold, where you own it for time forevermore, with this, you own it for a very specified period. Now, there's huge advantages in some ways to leaseholds in that normally your landlord is responsible for insuring the building, maintaining the building, doing those kind of practical things. And instead of you paying for the whole cost, you're sharing it with the other leaseholders. And also you're not having to do the actual arranging. But for some people, they have a very strong preference either way, I've found. And so when you have a lease, this is again the importance of having a very experienced and sensible solicitor, because you need to go through that document line by line and check that those rights and obligations actually work. We talked about lease extensions briefly. When you have a lease extension done, it's the obligation of the solicitor to read through the existing lease and check it actually works. You'd be surprised how many don't. One looked at with that fine-tooth comb. I once had a lease where they'd gone for 20 years and nobody had noticed. They didn't actually have a right to get from their front door to the street. And it had been bought and sold a few times and just nothing had been done about it. But of course, with the opportunity with the lease extension to just make those tweaks, we put the extra line in, problem solved. It was never going to be an issue again. That's the beauty of kind of a very experienced solicitor being able to do those kind of things and check it for you.
A situation where the property is owned by the shareholders of the people who live there. They form the housing group or managing that. So that's a share of freehold.
Yes. So a share of freehold can come in various different forms as well. But the most common one, I would say, is having a share of, share of freehold, but a share of a company that owns the freehold. So, for example, if we say that we've got a house that's called West Kent Radio House, we could have a management company called West Kent Radio House Limited. And as and when a new person buys into a flat, they're given a share in that company. And that gives them a say in the running of the company, how the maintenance of the building is going to be done, how they're going to set the service charges, etc. And so what you actually buy, normally estate agents will say to you, oh, it's share of freehold. And so people will come to me and say it's a freehold. It's not. Oh. It's two things. You receive your leasehold flat with all the rights and obligations that go with that lease, and also a share of the management company that owns the freehold.
And if you're a shareholder of the management company and your lease comes to an end, are you then responsible for evicting yourself?
Funnily enough, I've never come across that. I suppose technically, yes, you would be. although I imagine you'd be the person least keen. But what we tend to find where you have these share of freehold situations is most of the time, A, you're not charging yourself rent because you'd be taking it out of one pocket, putting it back into the other. But also you often find that they're then happy for you to have a lease extension. There would be no cost to extending the lease. Whereas if you have a separate freeholder, you would be paying them for the privilege. But also they will normally extend those leases much longer. You'll have a 999-year lease, say. Now, that's not always the case. There's different arrangements in different companies. Some management companies will charge a small amount of rent because that helps to cover the costs of running the company.
Yes.
And some will choose to go down those kind of routes. But, you know, in my personal experience, normally when you have a share of freehold, you have a very long lease with very little rent.
There's been a recent change in law, hasn't there, to leasehold properties?
There's been a few. So I suppose when we're talking about lease extensions, the most relevant one to think about is now, as and when you change your lease, they aren't allowed to charge ground rents anymore. So a ground rent is normally a fairly low amount of money that's paid almost as a token to your landlord for the privilege of having the right to live in the flat. Generally speaking, with most flats, it's less than £250. But what started to happen was landlords started to realise they could put clauses in that would increase that. And so it's something the government noticed, and therefore they've now said all new leases can't have ground rents. And when you do a lease extension, the rent that's already there you can keep, but once the new extended term starts, it must be zero.
Right, so gone to service charges.
Exactly.
Right, that's a good place to end it for this week. And you'll be back next month, and we will continue looking at conveyancing, looking at service charges and things like that.
All the exciting stuff.
So thank you very much indeed, Eleanor, for coming in this morning.
My pleasure, thank you very much.
And